It's big pouches, big guns, big attitudes. On this episode of
Comics of the Atom.
Welcome back to Comics of the Atom podcast, a series that examines some of the most influential and important comic book series and the people behind those creations. I'm your co-host, Michael Von Green, and my Sam to my Twitch, or my Twitch to my Sam, however you want to put it. Carson Wooder is here as well. Carson, how's it going?
Oh, man, I am ready for a totally radical 90s time with you today. I cannot wait to talk about the early 90s and Spawn. It's one of the best comic stories you're ever going to hear. It's just if you do enough research, it's the most fascinating time to me for comic books.
Absolutely. It is. It's a moment that will change the way that comics are made. It's, you know, I think when people probably think of Image Comics, they naturally probably think of Spawn, and that's about it. But I wonder today if it's just more about Walking Dead. But I think more people probably watch this series than actually read the comics. So we'll circle back to the Walking Dead. But yeah, our focus today, and this is sort of a different approach to what we normally do, which is like, hey, let's pick this, you know, influential story arc and talk about that, just like we did with Astonishing X-Men and Animal Man. This is more of like, hey, like this character, this moment in the early 90s with the arrival of Image and Spawn, is the moment is actually more interesting and, like you said, like an amazing story compared to the actual writing that goes on in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, me and you were kind of talking a little bit before you hit the live button. I mean, I definitely feel like we could sum up the first six issues in probably 5 minutes or less, but just the origin and the creation of Spawn, how we got to that point where Spawn number one was able to come out, and even the aftermath of the first arc of Spawn and the other Image titles, is worth a whole show in itself. So I definitely can't wait to explore all of this.
And yeah, well, so we'll just rewind it here a bit. And what is Spawn and who created Spawn? And that is, of course, Todd McFarlane. I'm sure anyone that's listening to this podcast understands that, and very recognizable name. But he, in the late 80s and early 90s, I think Marvel was like on top of the world in terms of comic publishing. I think they were putting out at least the probably, you know, 9 out of the 10, you know, top books every month. And that was probably largely due to some of these artists that are eventually going to go and break away from Marvel and form Image. You know, Todd McFarlane, he actually wanted to be a baseball player. So there's some great docuseries that you can find online. There's ones done by the Sci-Fi Channel, and there's another one that has this wicked name called The Devil You Know Inside, The Mind of Todd McFarlane, that talks a lot about his early life and his family and, you know, personal growth as an entrepreneur. Definitely go seek those out. I think they're super cool. So the baseball thing doesn't work out, but he knows that he's a good artist. So he starts, you know, basically spamming comic book editors every month with like 30 or 40 different packages going out. He claims that he's sent over 700. Eventually, someone at DC says, all right, you know what? I'm going to give you a dummy script. If you can, you know, look at the script and actually turn it into comic book panels, you know, we can have a discussion. So that leads to his, you know, getting his foot in the door. He does a few things for DC, and then he goes over and does the Hulk, which, you know, if you go and look at, it's got that famous cover, right, Carson? Like, it's probably one of the most infamous comic book covers in the Marvel compendium. can you describe it in any good detail?
Oh, yeah, the Incredible Hulk 340 during that, you know, infamous Peter David run. Just got Wolverine popping his claws, and then in the reflection, you just see the Hulk looking as sinister as he possibly can. So, you know, there's getting ready to be this big, huge showdown. So it's just one of those covers. It's like, I've got to see what's on the inside of this comic. And this is back when, you know, the cover actually kind of represented what would happen in the comic, unlike today. So absolutely, that had to have jumped off the shelves just once you see that cover.
Yeah, it's an amazing looking cover. This is the Gray Hulk era, and the way that McFarlane draws Hulk, he just makes him look like this really dumb oaf. Like, it's just he doesn't look like that today. It's definitely his own spin, but there's just an attitude. It's like super interesting, and this is where it's going to be revealed that like this is going to make McFarlane a success, because the way that he's tackling, like, he's changing the way eventually he's going to kind of change him and these other guys are essentially changing the way comics are drawn. I would say, like, you've got Jim Lee, you've got Rob Liefeld, Larson, and a few others, right, that are just doing these amazing work and bringing like this new style to comic books. And so with the success of Hulk, he jumps over to Spider-Man. And he actually starts to do some really cool things with Spider-Man, right, Carson?
Yeah, I mean, I was watching that the Sci-Fi Channel documentary that just came out recently. And I like some of his perspectives that he was talking about on Spider-Man, about how he wanted to do things that he had always wanted to see in a Spider-Man comic book and never saw before. And like the main example that stuck out to me is just like, I don't think I've ever seen Spider-Man shoot a web toward the reader or the viewer or the panel, basically. So then, like, some of his first images would be Spider-Man just literally popping through the panels on the page, you know, like he's in an Animal Man comic or something. And then he decided to make this distinguishable webbing, because before McFarlane, a lot of the webbing was almost just like a straight line or something. Yep. Very simple. And he, you know, almost coined the term spaghetti webbing around his creation. And I even remember watching on YouTube those clips from the comic book greats with Stan Lee. Or even Stan Lee is kind of just like, he's like, dude, what's up with the webbing? And yeah, you know, he just wanted to do something, you know, different and unique to his style. And yeah, it's definitely something that a lot of artists have adapted to their Spider-Man technique since.
Yeah, he almost creates like a new character inside mm-hmm. of Spider-Man. It's like the web has its own personality. And some of those covers, just like that Hulk Wolverine cover, like issue 300, and then he eventually gets to do his own Spider-Man series. Those two covers are extremely iconic, and especially the 300, which has 300 lettering in columns and rows. And it's just that famous pose that's been mimicked time and time again. Almost like it's just like if you think about that issue and then probably the first appearance of Spider-Man, right? Amazing Fantasy 15, right?
Yep, I think you got it.
Yeah, just like those two books. Those are probably the most infamous Spider-Man comic covers, and that number one. I'm not sure how familiar people are with the McFarlane owned. When I say owned, I mean he wrote it, and that's where all the trouble starts to brew. So he modernizes like Peter Parker and Mary Jane Watson. You know, before he took over drawing these characters, they were still drawn and like they were in the 1960s or something like that. So, and he also contributes to Venom, which, you know, like this is like what, 1990 maybe, or 91. I'm not sure when Venom arrives on the scene, but maybe 1989. I can't remember. But yeah, it's just like he's having this like huge influence and people are buying these books, right? Like he's becoming that rock star. But the problem is he's at Marvel. Marvel owns these characters. You know, he's seen some money, but right, the success of the book isn't necessarily because of, you know, the success of the character itself or even the writing, right? It's like McFarlane. And this is the same thing that's happening with like Liefeld, who's on X-Force. What's Silvestri on? I can't remember.
He did a lot of the Uncanny X-Men kind of right before Jim Lee.
Right.
They had an awesome stable of artists just on X-Men alone. I mean, that's where most of the creators came from for Image was the X-Men stuff, because you had Wills Portacio. I would do a lot of, you know, Uncanny X-Men as well. Mark Silvestri and Jim Lee all worked on that title. Actually, I think Wills was on the first appearance of Bishop, actually, during that run as well. So these guys, like, not only were they creating and coming up with the likenesses for all these iconic characters, and you hit the nail on the head, like, this was kind of like that transitional time where a lot of people were buying stuff to speculate on. They were buying stuff because they liked the artist. And I'll just bring up one of your notes here. I think, you know, what the proof was in the pudding when they moved Jim Lee and along with Chris Claremont, of course, the writer, to their own X-Men book. And it was like the second ever X-Men book, and it's still to this day by far the biggest selling comic book of all time.
Yeah. People say it's 8.1 million copies just on that single issue. And that's why when you go into comic book shops, you pull out a long box, and that long box is X-Men number one, X-Men number one, X-Men number one. So that book is worth nothing, I think. but I, yeah, for me, I mean, I know probably for you too, you know, that is one of my earliest memories of comic books. And I just remember that art being so cool. You know, the Magneto, he's in his bubble, and it's a gatefold cover too. And just that art was just like incredible. So, and this is like 1991, I think late 1991. I can't remember exactly when that comes out. Maybe like October or something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just like, and this is the beginning of like the comic book boom. Like, I think it was already like, obviously 8.1 million. That's insane. Right.
Yeah.
Like, I think probably Marvel today, a monthly book, I imagine probably does maybe 100,000 or something like that. I don't know what the ranges are, but there's no way. I don't think we'll ever see that again.
No.
Yeah, it's just
like, you can give a comic book away for free and you won't give away 8 million free copies of it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And they do that. They have free comic
books. Yeah, exactly.
But there's no way that they're giving away 8 million issues of a single series. But yeah, so this is 1992 is going to happen. And it is an insane year, because now that all this momentum is happening with the comic book industry, McFarlane and Liefeld, you know, are continually getting frustrated at Marvel because they want to do things their way. They see opportunities to kind of grow the medium in a way that they find more, I think, pleasing to themselves, like, you know, more adult readers, stuff like that. And I think the criticism is right, is like, some of the stuff that he wanted to do on Spider-Man probably doesn't need to belong in a Spider-Man book. It's not like you can't tell a mature Spider-Man series, but, you know, if you're familiar with Image and what it's going to become and the attitude it brings, it doesn't work really well with Spider-Man. At least not in this moment in time. So they're going to leave. They actually, if you watch these docuseries, I mean, they'll tell that story over and over again, but it's funny. Like, they get together and they just go to Marvel and say, "We're quitting. That's, we just wanted to let you know." And then what do? They walk across the street and also tell DC Comics the same thing, which is why? I don't know. Any thoughts on that, Carson?
Yeah, I guess I just didn't want their phones blew up, basically. So they're just like, "Hey, don't bother calling, because we're going to be your competition now." So you got, I mean, at the end of the day, like or hate these artists, basically, you got to respect the balls it took to make this move.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think McFarlane at the time is 30 something, maybe just 30. I think I remember hearing that Rob Liefeld was 23.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so they're going to form their own comic entity called Image Comics. Rob Liefeld created the logo. And so in April 1992, so they quit in December 1991. They work with Malibu Comics for publishing to get, I think, the first how many out the door. I'm not sure when they break off, maybe around issue 6 or 7 with Spawn. Before, you know, as like they got enough money to kind of publish on their own. I think that's how it works out. I'm not sure if Malibu is still around. Are they?
I think they were absorbed by Marvel back in the 90s. Mm. That's when you got like Juggernaut crossing into the Malibu universe, and they didn't really do a lot with the property after that. And then Marvel went bankrupt.
Yeah. So yeah. April 1992, Rob Liefeld's Young Blood comes out. And then a month later, and that does really well. That does over 1 million. And then Spawn number one comes out, and I've seen 1.7 million as like the benchmark. But also I've heard 2 million. So somewhere around there, like Spawn number one, instant success. It is huge. And Image becomes like it's just starting to eat, you know, the sales of DC and Marvel Comics. They have arrived, and they arrive very hot and heavy, and they make an impact. So, but what's also crazy about this year is all the other stuff that's happening or will happen in 1992. So April, May, this is the arrival of Image. But you also have later this year, you're going to have the X-Men and Batman animated series debut. Batman Returns comes out this summer. And the death of Superman happens, or at least that comic arc begins in December of 1992. A year before, Wizard Magazine arrives, which I know for both of us is like Spawn and Wizard Magazine seems to go hand in hand. Carson, you have some fun stories about how Wizard treated the sales of these books.
Oh yeah, every time we talk about Wizard, it was almost kind of like they were an independent published book themselves. So I think they really reined on to try and push some of these other independent publishers, like, hey, we'll scratch your back, you scratch ours, something like that. Who knows? But I remember early on, they were all about like Valiant Books and all that stuff when that launched in the early 90s. And then Image came along, and that's every other word in that magazine, I swear, was about Image Comics. So their hot tens were all like the number ones and twos and threes and so on and so forth. The hot 10 artists, I mean, that took 7 of the 10 spots were the Image founders, basically. And you just, if you read, especially like that first run of Wizard, if you read any of those, it's either all about Valiant up until the Image launch, and then it was pretty much all Image from there up until about the height of Gen 13, basically, is the one of my fondest memories, I guess. They blew that book up bigger than any other book that I could think of.
Yeah. It was, I remember that being, a lot of that happening inside of Wizard Magazine. And of course, you buy these books, right? You're going to be settled for retirement. You know, lock them in a vault because they're going to be worth a buttload of money one day. And that has not turned out to be the case. It's really important to understand too, is like Image is just an entity. Everybody that does a book with Image owns those creations, owns the rights, can do whatever they want with it. And so that's really cool, right? Like if you go and work for Marvel or DC and you come up with a character, they're going to own that character. Maybe over time we're going to see that change, but I still think that is largely the situation today. So it's just like, for example, Brian Michael Bendis created Miles Morales. Now, does he get any any kickback from anything Miles Morales related? I highly doubt it, but so Image didn't want to do that, right? So Todd McFarlane owns Spawn. Image does not own Spawn. So I think that's very important to understand. So that's the big thing that that's probably the most important thing that Spawn and Image bring to the table. The other, I think, more probably interesting thing that how Image changes the comic landscape is the artists themselves and the art that each of these books represent, right? And it sort of they sort of had their own house style. Would you agree? Like, I feel like they all have very similar art styles in terms of just how things are drawn, but it's just like it has a certain attitude to it, right?
Oh yeah, I would kind of agree with that for sure. Especially if you read or at least take a look at all the stuff that they published in the first 3 years of their existence. Some of it does sound pretty similar. I remember as a kid, I probably found most of the number one issues at flea markets and antique shops, just because I didn't really have a local shop to go buy these things from. And, I thought they're all, almost the same artist. And then, the older I got and more I started flipping through them, obviously I recognized the difference between, say, a Liefeld and a McFarlane. But I felt like Jim Lee and McFarlane had some pretty similar styles to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember being very confused. I always thought Youngblood and Wildcats were the same thing.
Right.
I just didn't understand. And I could not to this day, I could probably not tell you any character's name from Youngblood. but Wildcats is, yeah, that was the Jim Lee property. Mm-hmm. Eventually he goes and does, you know, he leaves Image and actually sells that property to DC. Mm-hmm. And so you get someone like Grifter showing up from time to time. Don't know, you know, for those three fans in the world that love Grifter, I guess, you know, you can, I guess you look forward every, yeah, I guess you look forward every 5 years to seeing him pop back up. But you get, like, wild things happen, right? Like the whole Neil Gaiman created Angela and Spawn, and now Angela is part of the Marvel universe, and it's just weird. Yeah, like, that's the flexibility that Image created. So in some ways that's cool, and it is a little odd, but I mean it's great that people that created the work can actually, you know, continue with it however they want. But let's get into Spawn, because I think Spawn, if you talk about the 90s, especially the early 90s, and you think about sort of the cultural era at the time, Image Comics and Spawn are definitely represent like a certain attitude. How would you describe the attitude of Spawn or Image itself, Carson?
Oh man, it was the 90s. It had to be in your face. It had to be, you know, alternative basically. So, you know, reading this, I just remember there was a lot of hearts literally ripped out of chests in this first six volumes. Like, it was just one quick flash to me of like what I'm thinking happened. And of course, you know, just a character like Clown. He's just this like foul mouthed, little short, fat, ugly character who you could probably, like, if this page had smell-o-vision, you'd take it back to the store. And of course, he can turn into Violator, which is just this grotesque, like almost alien looking devil or a hellspawn, basically. That is, you never seen anything like that up until that point in a comic book, most likely. So, yeah, it's definitely a lot of McFarlane's independent freedom is on the page right out the gate.
Right. It is, yeah, foul mouth. It is violent. It is dark. It is in your face. It is, you know, like we're not your, you know, mom and dad's comic book. We're the new thing, you know. And it definitely encompasses that 90s attitude, right? The alternative music, grunge music. I think Nirvana's Nevermind came out the year before. It is embodying this like new cultural movement, at least within the United States, or at least suburbia, you know, United States. And yeah, that's all. That's a big like impression that I had with Image Comics too, because I was like you, I was probably too young to like be like to remember 1992 and how big Image was. It wasn't until a couple years later that I probably like, oh, what are these books? Like, I think I got more interested in some of the later stuff, like The Darkness and Witchblade.
Oh, absolutely.
And stuff like that. You know, and I was very much like you could not. Yeah, like you knew what Spawn was. Like there was no, like you had to be living in a cave. He became quickly iconic, and is here to stay, right? I think like he's probably going to be around forever. But yeah, just that attitude that all these books brought, which was that's what it was. It was an attitude, and like the art really carried those books. Like if you go and read the writing, especially in these first six issues of Spawn, it is not a fun thing to read. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, it's just a weird observation. I found myself like wanting to take a break after every single issue break. I don't know. I don't have the greatest explanation why, but I would read an issue, I'm just like, oh, what's going on Instagram? And I'd read issue two, I'm like, ah, maybe I'll check Twitter now. And I just like, usually anymore I'm reading, I just keep going. But for some reason, like, I don't know if it was just too intense for me for early in the morning or what, or some of the parts were a little surprisingly dialogue heavy for having mainly an artist write this. But I know the observation I was telling you about is just like where McFarlane kind of tried to emulate this Frank Miller Dark Knight Returns style with the newsreels. I like the first one well enough because at least gives you that exposition on what happened to Al Simmons, what's going on with his wife, Wanda. And, you know, it kind of shows that she's a good person. She opens up a charity and Al Simmons' name, but then like another reporter is kind of talking about some of the darker stuff that Al Simmons did while he is alive and how he most likely got killed. And yeah, like that was good exposition the first time. And then you see him in the next issue and the next issue, and some of these guys are on different networks for whatever reason. You're just like, okay, enough's enough. I can't read these guys anymore.
It is. Yeah. It's very dialogue heavy, exposition heavy, but a lot of this stuff barely moves anything forward. I think it's a lot of just like, yeah, Todd McFarlane, an amazing artist. That's what he's probably really passionate about. And that's, he just wants to go and draw the giant pinup pages. Like he wants to, I'm going to put Spawn in this panel and I'm going to have him do this crazy thing. And like, that's the story he's trying to tell. Like all the words, I feel like get in the way of what he really wants to do.
Which I'm not sure if during the 90s, like my little like 8 or 10 year old brain, that's what I wanted to see in a comic though. I'll be completely honest. So like when I saw Splash Panels, like I need to get the next issue of Spawn because this book looks awesome.
And that's Tom McFarlane's attitude. He wants to draw cool stuff. He did some Batman covers, and I remember when I was doing research for this episode, I remember that cover because it's so wild. He's Batman is creating this woman and his cape is going all over the place, and it almost has this like, it looks like he has this like extended arm or something, like an extra arm inside his cape that's like juxtapositioning it upward. And it, I mean, it looks really cool. Logically, it makes no sense. But like you said, 10-year-old me is going to be like, whoa, that's super cool.
Right.
And that is exactly the attitude of Spawn and Image. Whoa, that's super cool, dude. Let's make it. And that led to somewhat some success. I don't think it's going to, like, the longevity of that, you're going to run out of gas very quickly if that's your approach to everything. But yeah, the way that he drew Spawn, right? Like the cape is just like the webbing. He finds these things that, you know, he can just bring all this character to life. And it's exciting to look at, right? Just flipping through the book. Like, yeah, like you, I was like, I don't want to read this. I just want to look at the art. And even some of the panel stuff that he did in this first six issues is really cool too. Like he'll use webbing to create non-traditional panels. He'll use blood. He'll use the chains, right? Along with the cape, tons of chains.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, you just look at the covers and it's just like all, there's so much love and detail that goes into that work, you know. Unfortunately, you can't translate that, I think, into good writing, but, you know, that's what Spawn, I think, is really about here early on. And then, you know, we could talk too about, like, if Spawn doesn't happen, you know, do you get Greg Capullo, you know, and like, it's, you know, he gets his feet wet with Spawn, right? And, you know, now obviously him and Scott Snyder are pretty tied together and he's done a lot of great work. So it was, you know, it's in the way that even Capullo, you know, is a very much Image artist too. I would say the way that he draws, like, is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Even on that, Todd McFarlane sci-fi documentary, he even kind of talked about how he doesn't think he's the strongest at drawing in anatomy. But he said like, go see Greg Capullo. He's the much better artist compared to the two of them. So that, I mean, just right there, that should give Capullo a ton of credit. But it's kind of funny you mentioned the impact that Image had on Capullo, because like, I wonder if, you know, they just kept working their day-to-day Marvel jobs, never broke away, if Capullo would have ever even been given that chance, because if it wasn't for like Liefeld taking out of that X-Force book, who stepped in to fill the shoes of Liefeld being gone? It was Capullo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So he got that opportunity because they went to Image, and then he got a later opportunity because McFarlane needed a break, and he filled in for a good chunk of the Spawn run, which became not the fill-in, but the regular artist after a while.
Yeah, that's super interesting. I did not draw that connection. Because they left, like, you know, they created a vacuum, and I think, and with their instant success too, I think DC and Marvel had to change their way of thinking about how to let artists have more freedom to bring in these different type of styles and personalities. And up until that point, I don't know if, you know, maybe somebody, I mean, there's a couple big artists, right? Like Jack Kirby, for example, right? Where I think people understood that name. But I think today it is very much a lot of books are just driven by the, not only the writer, but also the artist, right? I think I've brought it up here before on the podcast maybe, but for me, the biggest moment of Image history was Battle Chasers. And once again, an artist, Joe Maggiera. I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but he was doing X-Men, right? And it's funny, he goes and does his Image comic and that exploded. That was huge. So there's that funny history, very similar, right? Does X-Men, now Image, and then also follows it up with, well, you know, issue 2 will come out in 6 months, or and then issue 3 or whatever, 5 years. Battle Chasers is probably one of the worst delays in comic history. I can't think of anything worse than that, other than maybe the Kevin Smith Black Cat thing.
Yeah, I feel like we have to read that at some point. I feel like we mentioned it so many times. I can't remember if it was good or not. I just remember the art was fine, but yeah, the delays on that title were ridiculous.
Yeah, the writing isn't the strongest in that series. Like you can buy the collection now. There's only like 6 or 7. The funny thing is, not to get too far sidetracked, but they did when they did that Battle Chasers game, they did a Kickstarter for it. And, of course, Joe Mad was like, oh, man, we'll do comics, too. And I don't know if a single comic has come out. Maybe one.
Wow.
It's just, yeah. Yeah, like, didn't. And that's why I did not give to that Kickstarter, because I was like, oh, I want more Battle Chaser comics. And I'm like, no, remember Battle Chaser comics? They don't come out. Oh, yeah, you're right.
I will see you again in 25 years.
Exactly. Anyway, back to Spawn. So I think in this first run, there is a standout issue, and it's issue 5, and it deals with the character called Billy Kincaid, who's been locked up, and he's been given a clean bill of health from a psychiatrist, even though he was brought in locked up because he murdered a child, and it turns out he's an ice cream man, right? He lures these kids into his ice cream van and does horrific things. So this is also sort of the attitude of the early 90s, you know, this just in your face brutality. It's a very dark issue, right, Carson?
Oh my God, absolutely. Reggie Bannister, this ice cream man, is not like the second you see him get released from prison, like he immediately goes back to his old evil ways where he's like doing a finger painting with actual little girl fingers. And luckily Spawn starts to get some of his memories back, like where he had like $1 million hit on this guy. But then the company who commissioned him to do this, like had like some sort of mafia ties that was protecting Billy Kincaid or something like that. And all of a sudden there was no more $1 million bounty and he got arrested by the cops. And instead of having this long prison sentence, he was let go early. And yeah, Spawn's just like, never again. And you get to see more of that like anti-heroism where he just goes and basically obliterates the guy.
Yeah, the final page of this issue is pretty intense. Sam and Twitch, the two detectives that appear in the Spawn series. They were watching outside the house and they noticed Spawn is breaking in, but they're too late to stop them, and they open the door and it's a dimly lit room, so you've got the light coming in through the open door, and then it's just this, you know, and Billy Kincaid is a very fat, large man, and he's being hoisted up by the chains of Spawn, which I guess up until this point I guess he just has chains that he can quote unquote spawn and just leave around, I guess. But he's naked and he's just bloodying and he's got an ice cream bar shoved in his mouth. He's dead. And he's got this infamous note that's like, you know, he made boys scream, he made girls scream, I made him scream, 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 something like that. And it's it's a horrific, it's, you know, most of the stuff, I think, you know, you see Violator pulling the hearts out and whatever. It's just like, I kind of now like roll my eyes. It seems so tame today. But this is still like this. I think this stuff is like a lot more horrific, probably because it's just like a regular person. It's not like this monster being from hell.
I went back to the actual panel. I didn't realize he also stabbed him with several ice cream sticks and the blunt end of an ice cream scoop.
Oh, nice. I didn't see the scoop.
Yeah, that's what the
sign's attached. Jeez. This also reminds me, I don't know if you ever saw it, Carson, but this is this story appears in the HBO animated series that debuted in 1997, along with the Spawn movie that came out that same year, too. We can talk about the movie here in a second, but the HBO anime series is really cool to watch just because it really captures, I think, the Todd McFarlane art. And it really brings it to life. Like, the cape is really, really cool. Did you ever see that?
Oh, I remember, like, watching it the day it came out. Like, I was actually kind of pumped about the animated series. And this is kind of around the time, like, MTV was showing Aeon Flux. And you were starting to see a little bit more adult animation on the U.S. side. And at the same time as well, like, you got to remember Sci-Fi Channel, which back in the day it was a awesome sci-fi channel, not what we have today, even though I do like their comic book content. I don't want to deny that, obviously. But they were airing like Akira every Saturday and other anime. So you started to see this Japanese influence come into a lot of American animation to the point where we were kind of seeing this more adult form of animation. And Spawn was definitely, I think, influenced by that. Because obviously the cartoons you mentioned earlier, X-Men and Batman, kind of proved and set the style that, like, hey, like, you can take a comic book and make a really successful cartoon out of it. Like, once again, obviously Super Friends back in the day, it didn't age too well, obviously, but you can make these, like, stories that you can revisit again and again as a kid or an adult. And I think Spawn was just like, okay, adult, huh? We can make an adult cartoon. So I feel like of all the Spawn extra properties that came out, like movie, video game, cartoon, the cartoon has definitely got to be closest to the McFarlane vision, basically.
Yeah.
To the point where he was basically the crypt keeper of this dang thing. Like,
yes. So
you just get his narration, it'd cut to him in like his man cave or whatever, and then he'd talk about, you know, he'd talk all cryptic and stuff, and then you'd cut to the very awesome and stylistic cartoon. And the one memory, I think the opening scene, if I remember right, it could be just another episode, but my most memorable one is where this, like, perp is shooting. I think it starts with Sam and Twitch, and they're investigating, like, this burned body in an alley, and you kind of see through, like, you know, past flashbacks what happened to this perp, about how, like, Spawn basically covered him in gasoline, and the perp was, like, gonna shoot him, and Spawn's like, you don't want to do that. And then he shoots him, and then, like, a little ash sparks from his gun and just lights the guy on fire, and that's kind of how the series started, if I remember right. Maybe I could be completely wrong, as that was a second or third episode. But that's the first one I remember watching. And my little kid Brian's like, oh my God, that guy's burned alive. So I remember, like, I think it's like a very, like, only like six episodes or so. I could be wrong. But
yeah, I
really enjoyed them.
Yeah, if you have like HBO Max, they're on there now. And I watched them recently because I remember, like you, I had a very vivid remembrance of the show, but it was hard to find because it was on HBO, and
right, it was only at like 11:30 at night or something.
Never
only during the day.
Yeah, it ran for, it has quote unquote three seasons, and I think about only six episodes per season, and it's a continuation of the story keeps going and going, and as if like the way that a season would end, you know, it was like, okay, cool. Well, I'll figure out what's happening in the next episode. And then season three kind of ends in a way where it's like, I think they were going to make more, but it probably wasn't doing so hot. So they probably canceled it. Who knows? I have no idea about the historical run or production of that show, but that was way more successful vision than what we got with the Spawn movie, which I remember being very excited about. And then and my family even rented it from Blockbuster.
Oh, wow.
And I remember being so disappointed with just the effects and just the way that they told the story. It is not a good movie.
Yeah, that was around the time he got properties like Mortal Kombat and, you know, even Super Mario Brothers made in.
Yeah, oh God, yeah.
Batman Forever was out with Batman and Robin coming next. And yeah, you had a lot of movies that were starting to utilize CGI. And obviously CGI is a mainstay today. That's how they do almost everything in filmmaking. But in the late 90s, oh God, it's almost unwatchable today because of the CGI. But I will say this about the Spawn movie, like, I really enjoyed Michael J. White as Al Simmons. Like, I feel like that was the right casting call. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the movie was just mundane.
Right. Yeah, he's great as a Spawn. In the same way that Keith David in the HBO series absolutely is a great Spawn. Yeah, it's like, oh, wow, this is, yeah, perfect. Like, bring him back somehow. So I know that McFarlane has done some type of pre-production on a new Spawn movie. It seems kind of wild. Like, it's not really going to focus so much on the Spawn character, but more about the people or it's not like an origin story or a reboot or anything like that. So I'm not sure, but I'm not, and he wants to direct it and all that. So I'm not confident that will be, who knows, that movie could be worse than 1997 movie.
The pitch is compelling to me. I mean, if it actually comes to fruition based on the pitch, I may actually go and see it if that's a thing we can do. but from what I've heard, it's just like the stars are Sam and Twitch, and they're investigating like these incidents that are going on. That's pretty much like what they're doing in Spawn 1-6. They're just kind of like, what is going on? Like, people are dropping dead left and right. There's like all these anomalies and random sites. It's kind of like they're Gotham centralizing this thing where, mm-hmm. you know, you take Batman out and you bring in, you know, Gotham Precinct, and they have to deal with all this crazy stuff that's going on around them with characters like the Joker and Mr. Freeze. So it's basically, it sounds like you're taking that same principle and applying it to Spawn, whereas, you know, Sam and Twitch are your main characters and you're trying to figure out like, who is Spawn? What is a Spawn? Is he a murderer? Does he mean well? Is he here like causing chaos? Like, what is happening? And I think it's a Blumhouse production from what I've heard, supposedly.
Yeah.
So obviously the budget's not going to be very high on this thing. So the less Spawn and crazy stuff you have, the more you're going to save on budget if it's just two detectives standing there in an investigation scene. So I get why they're going that direction. But obviously there's nothing concrete yet, so we can't really say if it's going to be good or bad.
Right. You would need a huge budget, I think, to do the Spawn character justice in the way that the HBO animation did it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, I can't imagine, like, that's what I want to see. Just like this very well done cape and chains and just that, the attitude that the comic book brought. Like, I want to see that realized on screen. But yeah, you're right. Like, that, if it's coming out of Blumhouse, it's low. Yeah, that budget, it probably costs a lot of money to get that stuff to animate. You remember in the 1997 movie, he comes crashing mm-hmm. into that museum or wherever they're at, and like that cape is animating. I wonder back then how much that cost.
Oh,
like,
God.
How many computers did they have running? And like, all right, we'll check back in 3 days and we'll have one second of render done.
It aired on the network Stars constantly. They're the ones who got the rights to that movie.
Yeah.
So I think they're the ones that, like, if you stayed tuned after the movie, like, you could actually like watch like a DVD extra basically before that was a thing. And I remember, like, it was like some CGRs talking about how proud they were of that cape effect.
Oh, I bet.
And yeah, exactly. Now, obviously, it's just it dates the movie so bad when he comes down from the ceiling.
It's hot garbage for sure. I'm sure there was a lot of incredibly talented, smart people that made that scene, but it does not hold up, like you said. But yeah, that's sort of like. I would encourage anyone just to go back and read, you know, the first six issues. I think very quickly, because of some of the criticism, McFarlane hires like Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman, some other people, to actually do some writing on Spawn, which I don't think I've ever read. So, you know, I definitely want to go and kind of check that stuff out. I'm sure it's better than what we have here in the first six issues. So, but the art is just insanely compelling, right? It there's a reason why, and the character too. Like, even though, I mean, that's the funny thing. McFarlane made this when he this character when he was 16 and updated it. When it obviously, you know, based on what he had done all those years ago, but it definitely does feel like, oh, this is a character a teenager would make. And like, that's very much like the Image attitude too. Like, whoa, what would be cool, man? Oh, this would be cool. But yeah, like, I think Spawn is probably here to stay. And they just, this past year, right? They did 300 and 301. So now it's the longest running creator owned comic book of all time.
It passed Cerberus, which I believe that's the one that crossed 300. And I've also noteworthy, not too far behind it, Eric Larson's Savage Dragon's still going.
Yep.
Just Dragon, yeah. Race, but it's still a thing. It exists. So it's probably going to hit 300 one day and keep going until, you know, Eric Larson decides to, you know, kind of just hang it up finally, which probably isn't anytime soon. So,
yeah. Yeah, what's cool in the first couple issues of this of Spawn 2 that we didn't mention is that Savage Dragon does appear on, like, I think some televisions in one scene. Someone makes reference to the Young Bloods, I think, in the first couple pages of the first issue, right? And you had a funny observation.
Yeah.
You felt like
I don't know if it's just breaking Rob Liefeld's balls, but it seemed like there's like at least three mentions of Youngblood, and every time Youngblood gets mentioned, it's like some little kid talking about how bad the costumes are, about how bad Youngblood is, or just saying like, oh yeah, Youngblood, whatever. So I thought that was kind of funny. Like, even though like there's probably only one issue of Youngblood out at that point in time, like Todd McFarlane was still like throwing shade at it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, don't want to get too far down a Rob Liefeld hole. You know, I understand why people flock to his art, you know, but I've never liked it. I think it is probably the pinnacle example of like bad 90s attitude. Like, you know, it's just this, everything is so over the top, right? The pouches joke, that's an easy thing to make fun of, but just, yeah, proportionally, he could never, McFarlane is the better artist, like, especially with Spider-Man, the way that he was drawing him as this more, like he would put it, like, Spider-Man, like, he was bringing that, you know, kind of natural movement to that character, and he did it in all these, like, great poses. Like, Liefeld just couldn't, he can't draw perspective very well. It's all just like he picked up these like bad habits and really was able to consistently do them well, right? Like, he was, it's just, I don't get it, man. Even to this day, I remember we went to C2E2 a couple years ago and he was there as like a special guest.
Yep.
And people were freaking out, and I was like, I would never, I mean, nothing against the guy at all, but it's just like, I don't understand why anybody would be like, oh, cool, I've got some Liefeld art to hang up. Maybe it's nostalgia. I get it. It's like he was influential. And if it isn't for Rob Liefeld, I think McFarlane, that his attitude, he would eventually go and do his own thing. But, you know, to give credit, like, Liefeld is sort of the spark that Image is created on. So, and he did create a very good logo.
Yeah, I know he also influenced Robert Kirkman quite a bit, too. Robert Kirkman, at the end of the day, was a pretty big Liefeld fan, and I think Liefeld did a lot to encourage Kirkman to kind of keep the Image brand going down the years, too.
Yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, that's I'm glad you brought up Robert Kirkman, because, you know, I would encourage everybody that's listening to go check out those sci-fi docuseries, and also the Devil You Know Inside, The Mind of Todd McFarlane. Those are all on YouTube if you want to learn more about Todd, but also the sci-fi stuff does a great job of telling the history of Image. So Image was huge, and just like a lot of things in the 90s, it burned very brightly, and then it died very quickly. And so it was, you know, yeah, like 1997 is probably the biggest moment, or at least for Spawn, in terms of just public awareness. But after that, you know, things started to fizzle out. You know, I remember the Darkness. I remember Witchblade, you know, and just Image being there. But it was never that big again until Robert Kirkman comes along and does Invincible and The Walking Dead. And, yeah, like the one thing I learned about through the sci-fi stuff is that I always thought Invincible came after The Walking Dead, but it actually started before that, which I thought was interesting. So, but yeah, Kirkman, obviously, Walking Dead, huge, you know, almost in a way, like, really changes the Image Comics forever. Like, now you go into a shop, there's so much diversity with that label. It's awesome. Like, anybody can come to that company now, like, if they've got clout and say, hey, I want to do this book, and they're willing to just put out like 5 or 6 issues. And if it's a success, great. If it's not, then, you know, on to the next thing. You know, Carson, besides, you know, Walking Dead and Invincible, I know for me, like, some of the stuff that I really like now from them is, you know, the Wicked and the Divine saga. I'm trying to think of some other stuff, like, you know, Chew, right? You're a big fan of Chew's. Chew's Image, right?
Oh, yeah, Chew. They actually just relaunched the title called Chew with Tony Chew's sister. So we're finally getting a sequel series of that. Farmhand's another one from Rob Guillory as well. So offer both of those guys the opportunity to kind of splinter off and create their own books. Image has been very good to Brian K. Vaughan as well. We got to kind of mention Brian K. Vaughan. You mentioned Saga. We can talk about Paper Girls as well. Paper Girls is a phenomenal run.
There's so much great stuff out there. Like, it is, I mean, what I would recommend anybody do is that go to your local comic book shop. They make everything very, like, Image does a great job of making things super affordable. So just they put out paperbacks, like, all the time, and they're like anywhere between like $7 and $10, probably a little bit more, you know, depending on how many issues are in there. But just go and look at stuff, just it's like almost like, I think it's in the vein of like how Image started, which was, hey, we want to just make really cool looking stuff. Like, just that's the thing with, like, just go and look what you think looks cool. Just go pick it up. I mean, it's $10. Who cares, right? Well, I don't mean to be insensitive about money, but it's just, you know, like, what issue, Marvel issues now are like $5 or something, like a single issue. So, you know, that you may or may not even like go find those independent creator owned titles. And there's a lot to love there. So
they definitely dominate the trade and hardcover shelves. I don't think that can be understated, just because, like, if you go in any comic shop or
book, yeah,
like, sure, like, Marvel and DC probably sell consistently a lot more single issues, but if you look at the trades and the hardcovers that, you know, the local shops are trying to sell you, it's almost all consistently the same books from Image.
Yep.
They're on top of those shelves because they know that's the books that people are kind of going to be looking for and forming binge reads out of.
Yep. And I don't think and it's all because we had some young artists that wanted to draw giant pouches. this is where it's led to. So,
I mean, hey, it's just 7 artists. They kind of wanted a little bit more, you know, rights to their characters and creations. And mm-hmm. They decided they needed to create that model because they weren't going to be given that model from the big guns. So it's like McFarlane uses that example in the latest documentary he was in. He's just like, well, if something isn't done to my standards, I'm just going to try to create it myself. And we haven't even mentioned McFarlane Toys yet, about how he wanted to make Spawn Toys, and, you know, the other founders were just like, yeah, sure, whatever, Spawn Toys, I guess you're gonna, like, and everyone's like, ah, we're gonna get Savage Dragon to Hasbro or whatever, and he's just like, yeah, I wouldn't mind Spawn at Hasbro, but I don't like the way they would sculpt it. So he just made his own version that was more for adults, and like, toys for adults, like, are you kidding me? And boy, did he tap into something that, you know, everyone else probably wish they would have thought of back then.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the same attitude and drive that created Image and Spawn, and I remember being amazed by these toys. And I had the giant garbage monster from Spawn. I didn't even know. I don't even think I eventually went and found like the issue that that came from. I think it might have been that time Greg Capullo may have been drawing it too. But I remember that toy just being so cool. Like, oh my God, like, look at all this detail. Look at all this craft. And like, he did X-Files. He did some monster stuff. And yeah, and it's still around today. And the, funny enough, he's like doing like DC stuff now, like very affordable DC toys, which look really great. I know they did the Batman black and white, and it looks like really, really cool. So yeah, it's yeah, he just started all these things that I think today they seem so commonplace. And then it's like, oh yeah, like there was a time when none of this existed. None of this like high quality craftsmanship, not only from a toy perspective, but also from like, you know, a comic book perspective. Like it is, it, yeah, it, what he did with Spawn and what the Image artist did, like has had giant effects that I think are still felt to this day and continue to, right? Of course, with Kirkman's success. And
like the successful formula for a writer now is to almost like get in the door at DC and Marvel and just like put in the work there, and then hopefully someone at Image will notice you, and then you can start your book at Image and then get your the right your characters you want to create. Because I just know, once again, like Scott Snyder, Brian K. Vaughan, Ed Brubaker, it seems like all those guys are slowly drifting towards Image.
Yep. And then Hollywood comes knocking. Or Netflix or somebody, right?
Another one.
Yeah.
Millar World and Image are now a thing. And basically,
oh yeah,
this is all about Millar World now.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, it's very cool. So I think we'll wrap it up, and yeah, I think we'll do a couple of these before we tackle our next big book, which I don't think we've decided on. So I'm not sure what is next, but you know, catch us here in another 2 weeks, and we'll have something new to talk about. Yeah, thanks Carson for going down this nostalgia filled journey with me. It was especially when I was looking up 1992 and I was like, oh, I can't believe all this stuff hit then. That is crazy, because it had such a profound impact on like, you know, who I was as a person and the things that I like.
I mean,
I'll continue to like today.
Got me into comics. So, I mean, you mentioned the Death Man earlier, and that's what started it all for me.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, man, I know there are podcasts out there, but it's just like, yeah, I would love to talk about every single episode of the Batman animated series. It's just that I love that show. Bruce Timm works there is just genius. And it still holds up incredibly well. All right, Carson, where can people find you, online? And, yeah, what's happening on the other side with some of your comic core stuff?
Oh man, if you search CWoodard19 on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, you can find me at any of those avenues. On my own channel, I actually just did an unboxing. I bought something from the Kevin Eastman store, 2 mystery packs. So I got a nice whole bunch of Ninja Turtle run filler from runs I can never find anywhere. So if you guys want to see what book.
Oh, nice.
Tune into that. Actually, he threw in a Kevin Eastman signed book that was part of the deal too. So that's always fun to get a signature. You know how much I like signatures. Comic Core wise, we actually had a good episode of Comic Core Roundtable, which is Friday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern. We talked about the toys that made us and, you know, talked about that Netflix series a little bit. Add our own perspective about toys we collect. And then Modern Men will be airing at 10 p.m. Eastern Monday night. We're going to talk about Thor by Jason Aaron, Volume 1. That's the Jane Foster introduction run. And we're going to talk about confusing numbering on books, because my co-host, Conkman Andy, had a heck of a time trying to figure out which run he was supposed to read. And it was very hard for me to explain which run he needed to read. So I can't wait to talk about this like crazy trend in numbering since like the New 52 and Marvel Now and that stuff, because it's something I always like to rant about.
Yeah, it's that numbering stuff I think has gotten out of hand. I think the I understand why they do it. I think the way they fix it is they should just do seasons or something, like season, you know, 8, issue 1 or something like that. They need to come up with some type of something other than number 1. Like, it just doesn't work anymore.
Working on that with his Green Lantern run.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that in season. So we'll see how that works out.
Cool. Hopefully well. All right, yeah, and then people can find me, Raptors Revenge. I looked at the numbers, and like we've had over 100 listens now, which is amazing. So thank you for the people that are tuning in. Really appreciate. I hope we're, you know, bringing some type of enjoyment or some type of. Hopefully, you're learning a few new things. I know that I'm always learning every time I do this podcast, and Carson, it's always great to talk with you. So. We'll catch you back here in 2 weeks.
Later.